This is Dick Hain, and it's a session titled Politics and Policy as Spiritual Disciplines. Do help yourself to any of the material that's out here. Some of it is, just briefly, this is something about how the congressional budget process goes. This is why people ought to be involved. This is a media kit, how to do interviews and do media work and so forth. Just a newsletter, summary of the Dodd-Leahy bill on military assistance to El Salvador. Bibliography, something on militarization power in El Salvador, which we'll come back to after a bit, maybe. Something on third world debt, the harvest of peace, reduction in military expenditures, and increases for human needs. This is a brochure for next year's offering of letters. We do an annual offering of letters. And we produce a kit, and I'll talk about that more later, but next year's offering of letters is going to be on the Horn of Africa. Horn, because if you looked at it this way, it's like a rhinoceros horn. Sudan, Somalia, Ethiopia, Tigray, Eritrea. The kit will be out. Carol actually is the director of communications at Bread for the World, and she's the one who produces the materials. And
So she can sit in the back row because she knows all this.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Come on, she knows all this. And these are little citizen action guide and little background papers on. This one's on budget. This one's on Horn of Africa. This one's on ag and trade and development, and that's on debt. In addition, if any of you are interested, part of what's going on here is that I came from a weekend retreat in Texas, where we had 5 Bread for the World staff, and there were some materials that they had left for me to bring here. Among them are some little packets that our person put together on El Salvador and third world debt. They include these background papers and then some other articles and pieces of information. I have them, would be happy if you would like one. I have 3 on four on El Salvador and 1 on third world debt. So I'll put those out here, and if we get time, may refer back to them later. When we were here the other, let me just back up. Some of you have been here multiple times, and I know this is sort of coming and going. Overall, you know, at the broadest level, what I'm claiming is that social life, social interaction, parent-child, lover-spouse, friends, on one-on-ones, have spiritual dimensions. We think of them. And it's in those relationships that we experience some of the most profound depths of what it means to be human. When someone who is close to us celebrates great joy, or when someone who's close to us has deep pain, you feel that almost more intensely than anything else that happens to you, apart from your own physical debilitation or death, something like that. And even part of the business of personal physical debilitation or death is a separation from those people. So at some level, the most profoundly meaningful social experiences that we have are social experiences. And the claim simply is that those are, therefore, if you look at them, also can be characterized as spiritual experiences. That if you look at what you mean by spirituality, what you ordinarily would talk about as religious experience or spiritual experience, that you have that just in ordinary, everyday social interaction. One-on-ones, larger groups, identity groups. I should think that Holden is a spiritual community. I think Holden would be a spiritual community of some sort, or maybe there are sub-communities there here. I'm not here long enough to sense all that. Even if it weren't church-based. I don't think a group of people who share a commitment to this kind of lifestyle and in contact with nature like this could be other than a spiritual group, even if there was no church connection or ostensible religious purpose. I think of it in terms of other identity groups, whether professional groups. I used to do some sailing, and people used to come out there in Texas, Lake Benbrook, and they'd have these little sailboats, and they'd hang out all day and drink beer and have a great time together. There's a kind of spirituality involved in that.
Or certainly in 12-step groups. It's very clear in 12-step groups, Al-Anon and so forth, Narcotics Anonymous, all that kind of groups. Within social groups, then, that's the broadest level claim. And it's not a stunning claim at all, except if you've been brought up in the traditional American religious sector, you weren't taught that. You just weren't taught that. At least I wasn't. Very few of us were taught that. I think some other religious systems would recognize that and say, well, yeah, of course, and now tell us something. Within that, I guess I would want to claim that politics is the way in which, not the way, but a major way, a very major way, in which we order our social life together. It's how we build a future together. It's how we keep from killing each other, even at the most basic level of who drives on which side of the road. I mean, you have to have some way of regulating things to keep people just safe. Food security, food safety, some way of regulating so that the market has not shown a great propensity to be self-regulating. And if it were not for the Food and Drug Administration, you know, there'd be no telling what's in the sausage you eat. I don't know if any of you ever read, is it Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, mm-hmm. about the meatpacking industry and the cancerous chicken and all that that would go into sausages and all, one of the muckrakers of the early 20th century. What changed all that? What changed all that was the food and drug laws. Now, that doesn't mean food and drug laws are always good. It doesn't mean they're perfect. It means they err. It means they drag their feet sometimes and they should go fast. Whatever. But in any case, without the regulation, the situation would be extremely serious for each of us. You could never know whether the food on your plate was more wholesome or poisonous. Even now, it's kind of iffy sometimes. It's just longer.
It's very iffy.
Yeah, but it's longer term. It's not quite so direct. So the claim is then that politics is a way in which we bring about our social and economic life. It's a way in which we create a future, and therefore, as a way of organizing our social life, is important because it can lead to the increase of spirit. To me, spirituality is not just, it is these things. We were brainstorming the other day and people were saying what spirituality meant to them. Connectedness, awe, mystery, uplifting, clarity, calmness, integration, health, wholeness, joy, ecstasy, awareness, increase, and I added increase of spirit. We tend to think of spirituality as a personal experience, but suppose we looked at spirituality not only as a personal experience, but as a result, okay? That is to say, you can talk about something resulting in the increase of spirit, by which I mean something that results in the increase of good, or something that results in the increase of the sway of God. Politics, as I said the other day, has the capacity for increase or decrease, has the capacity on a massive scale to enhance the sway of good or enhance the sway of evil. The sway of evil most clearly in, say, a Nazi regime or something like that. But in any case, because politics moves at such a large level in shaping our life together, it has enormous potential for good and for evil all at the same time. And what you always get is a mix of both, of course. You never get one or the other. In political involvement, one can have experiences of these sorts that can be identified as spiritual experiences, even as a one-on-one experience can be identified as a spiritual experience. Not only, however, does it lead to the increase of one person, as in a one-on-one experience, but it has the potential to lead to the increase of good for thousands of people, millions of people.
I used to argue when I was teaching in seminary that most of my students were Bible Belt people, and most of them saw ministry in terms of pastoral counseling. And when a family is in crisis, there does need to be someone there, whether it's a marital crisis or a problem with a child or illness. That is an important function of ministry. But I used to say, you know, you could spend your time tutoring one child, or you can spend your time working on the school board so that there is a tutoring program for 1,000 children. You can take one Mexican-American kid, which was my context at the time, and help them learn English, okay? And that's a good thing to do, and people need to do that. But there are a lot of people willing to do that. There are not so many people willing to hunker down and work for 3 years, to work for 3 years on that school board to create a bilingual education program or to create a tutoring program, whatever the appropriate policy may be. But when you have done that, you have not only affected that one child, you have affected thousands of people over a long period of time. And that's why, at least that's part of why politics is so important. I have a very brief video. I don't remember whether I've shown this. Well, I showed this when I was... It's 30 minutes, but I'm just going to show you the first 3 to 5 minutes. And it has to do with... well, ecological stuff, social stuff, and political stuff. It's a United Nations video. Comments.
That's a little powerful little cartoon. Very strong, isn't it?
Anyone else?
What was the nationality of the creators of the cartoon?
I don't know. It was right at the end there, and
yeah, sort of cartoon.
Yeah, I don't know. It's
what would the Pentagon do?
What would the Pentagon do? Well, gee.
I read that piece somewhere after the Eastern European children said, "Oh, what's the Pentagon going to do to get its budget?"
Iraq.
Iraq, of course, immediately.
Yeah. Something like 50% of the U.S. military dollar is used to defend Western Europe from Eastern Europe, to defend West Germany from East Germany. I mean, the level of absurdity has become very dramatic in the past year. It's not, and it has some images there, like even in the rainbow time, you've got automobiles, which, you know, you would not probably go that way, but, and it has high-tech ag development with, you know.
I thought you'd have buses instead of all of your.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, there are a few things that are left to be desired in the thing, but I guess what I would do with that, I mean, the obvious point has to do with the arms race, but, one point I would make from that is the power of the vision which is presented by the Rainbow Time is a religious vision, is a spiritual vision. And it's that kind of set of images, and it's one reason why I think people can identify heavily with the ecological movement. I mean, you just sit here and look out the window and you've got the power of that vision coming right straight at you in reality. And the deformations of it are very obvious, whereas we just don't encounter hunger or things like that on as regular a basis, so it doesn't hit us as quickly, as often. So one is that the vision of the ideal world, the world to which we would move, is a religious vision, is a spiritual vision. And even to me, even when I watch that cartoon, there's a certain feeling that comes that I think is a religious feeling. Second point I would make from it is, apart from the obvious militarization thing, is that how do you get from here to there? How do you get from here to there? And I would say that it's not that there's only one way, but that, frankly, politics is the engine. Politics and economics are the engine. And the question is, which will dominate over the other? Politics moves it faster, farther, bigger than any other vehicle. For good or for ill. And therefore, you know, to me, involvement in politics is a spiritual vocation. It is a commitment that one makes to participate in that ideal world, that rainbow world, even when you're standing in the mud. And goodness knows, politics is mud. But it's hanging on to that possibility, that vision, that hope, when other things seem quite hopeless, and when you work and you work and you work and you work and it doesn't happen or doesn't seem to happen. The spiritual disciplines of politics are such things as letter writing. What a drag! What a drag! Right? I mean, but then losing weight isn't any fun either, is it? Or giving up, you know, if you have used some abusive use of alcohol or drugs or something, giving that up isn't easy either. Well, neither is politics easy. It's just that discipline of working day in and day out and refusing to quit because that religious vision is more powerful in the long term than the inconveniences and frustrations and so forth of a given present. So I would say, you know, not just I, but the way I'm putting it in this at this time is that, stated negatively, politics is the way in which we solve together the problems we cannot solve alone. Okay? I can't solve the problem of water pollution alone. There are things I can do. I can conserve water. There are a whole bunch of things I can do about, say, water. But I can't, by myself, deal with a factory that is producing millions of gallons of polluted water. They aren't going to pay attention to me. I don't have any clout over them. But politics, when people bind together, either through government or through community organizations, but through combining their efforts together, you can stop a major factory from certain kinds of pollution. It's a tough go. It's a tough go, and it's a slow go. That's stated negatively. Politics is the way we solve together the problems we cannot solve alone. Stated positively, politics is a way we build together a more just, humane, and renewable world. It's always a little confusing to me when some well-meaning member of Bread for the World says, I'm having a hard time getting my people in my church to pay attention to this because they think that Bread for the World is political, and I know it's just Christian. And so I want you to come and explain how it's not political. And that leaves me kind of high and dry. Especially if they want a one-sentence answer. Because what they sometimes mean by political is partisan. People use that word a lot. When they say political, they often mean Republican or Democrat. It's really what they mean by it. Well, Bread for the World, like many movements, is nonpartisan. Do not believe that all of the compassion, all of the wisdom is in a single party. When we had the Harvest of Peace resolution, we wrote a resolution that was introduced into Congress this spring. We made sure that in the Senate it was introduced by a Republican, and that the first co-sponsor was a Democrat. When it was introduced in the House, it was introduced by a Democrat. and the first co-sponsor was Republican. And we held the bill up for a month till we found the right people to do that. That is to say, there was no way we were going to come in there with a Democrat in the House and Senate or a Republican in the House and Senate. And there was no way the first co-sponsor was going to be anything other than the other party. And we'll wait till we find the right combination, the right people, to symbolize the fact that that hunger is not a party issue. It is not a partisan issue. It's also, honest to goodness, just realistic politics. If you're going to win, you got to have support on both sides. And so it's just plain practical politics, quite apart from a matter of principle. So this person will come up and say, explain how bread for the, it's only Christian, it's not political. And all I can say is, we're just as political as we know how to be. Whether our strategies, you know, we write letters, grassroots people make phone calls, they form telephone networks, they do offerings of letters in churches, they form local groups that meet monthly, year-round, and study issues and write letters. But that's a discipline. You get this newsletter every month that Carol produces. You get this newsletter every month, and there'll be an issue almost every month. Not every month is there an issue, but usually when Congress is in session, there's an issue. There's a specific bill that you can write a letter about. It takes a discipline to sit down there and write that letter. So in a lot of communities, people form local groups where there'll be five people. It's sort of like, I suppose, Bread for the World's version of the 12-step program or something like that. That is to say, there'll be 5 or 10 people. They'll get together and they'll write their letter together. And because the other ones are there, you know, you sort of have extra impetus to do that. And also we lobby in Congress. That is, we go to Capitol Hill, members go to Capitol Hill, staff go to Capitol Hill, and we speak to members of Congress and their aides on hunger legislation. Frankly, you have more clout with your member of Congress than a Washington-based office. A movement that is not a grassroots movement lacks an effective political base. We have one of the largest grassroots movements in the country on justice issues. There are also Sane Freeze has a large network on peace issues, and the Sierra Club and some environmental groups have large grassroots networks on environmental issues. Common Cause has a large grassroots network on the issues it works on, due process and so forth, and the ACLU and so forth. But we have a large grassroots network, and you can talk to your member of Congress in person. We wind up talking to aides. Now, the aides are important, but nonetheless, you have ordinarily direct access to your member of Congress. I think I mentioned the other day, Craig Fiarly and Sharon D'Amico and John Terry over in Seattle talked to John Miller, Representative John Miller, in August, and he co-sponsored the Harvest of Peace resolution. That kind of thing goes on all over the country. Now, it doesn't promise if you show up and talk to them, they're going to sponsor or vote. That it means you've got their ear, you're their constituent, you're the one that elects them. Public policy is a spiritual discipline because, picking up on the word discipline, I mean, you can, and I think it's probably a worthwhile thing to do, to sit on a mountain and do Buddhist chants. I mean, I wouldn't put that sort of thing down. I think it requires an incredible amount of discipline, and I think it's probably a good thing for some people to do, and wouldn't mind trying it myself sometime. But it takes an enormous amount of discipline to study public policy and to figure out what kinds of things do you want to have happen. What kinds of things will cause this increase of spirit or this increase of good? Well, enlarge the arena of good. And that's where groups and like environmental groups and Bread for the World and Sane Freeze try to provide you with materials that will help you in your research process, that will help you make that transition from complex legislation to specific action now. So you can get your hands on it, so you can get your head around it. I would say that participation in the political process can provide all kinds of spiritual experience. I don't know, for me, I had experiences in Chicago in the late 60s in a variety of contexts with Operation Breadbasket or when I was doing my dissertation research that were profoundly moving experiences that have formed part of my heart, that are part of my identity, that are part of, when you say, who are you? Part of that identity was given symbol and shape by certain important experiences having to do with, at that time, mainly racism, and then subsequently the war in Vietnam and so forth. I'd like to read you a letter. It's a bit long, but I think it's nonetheless a worthwhile letter. It's a letter that I got from someone who had been a participant in a more dramatic kind of political thing than Bread for the World normally gets involved in. It was a march that attempted to cut off the Department of Energy. It was when nuclear testing was about to be resumed. And there were a group of people who went to D.C. or who lived in D.C. and got together and joined arm in arm and surrounded the Department of Energy and tried to shut it down just for a little while as a kind of symbolic protest at what was occurring there. And it happened that my second daughter was in D.C. at the time on an internship working for Women's Strike for Peace, a feminist peace organization. And she participated in that event. And she wrote this letter shortly thereafter. And I think this letter is an example of participation as a spiritual experience which has the potential to enlarge the arena of good or spirit. Dear friends, lovers, and family, I never asked her what all of that meant. I decided that there are some things a father doesn't want to know. It's time for me to send another group letter out. In the past week or so, I've received letters from a lot of you and so forth. Times have been very busy and very exciting for me. Last weekend was a virtual dragon of charged events. Friday night, Women's Strike for Peace celebrated its 25th anniversary by holding a reception to honor its founder and its national legislative coordinator. It was great to hear the highlights of the past 25 years of Women's Strike for Peace activism. Women have been working for 25 years. The strength of the women who have kept on protesting war and the production of nuclear weapons all these years is impressive. Saturday morning, I met the Great Peace March at Malcolm X Park, where we rallied, singing with Peter, Paul, and Mary, clapping and cheering. The park was crowded. We marched in silence to Lafayette Park, across from the White House, where we rallied some more. These are religious services. These are spiritual events. Oh, this is my parentheses here, obviously. Speakers there included Representative Ed Markey, Eleanor Smeal, president of NOW, victims of radioactive testing in Nevada and the Bikini Islands, and others. Spirits were high, and maneuvering through the cheering anti-nuclear crowd was difficult because of the numbers present. Then we marched on to the Lincoln Memorial, where we rallied, sang, and danced some more. There were Hiroshima survivors who spoke, as well as members of the 3,700-mile Great Peace March, Jesse Jackson, and so on. Holly Neer and a band or singing group called Wild Women for Peace performed. I actually met Holly Neer backstage. I was so excited to meet her that my face turned beet red, and all I could think to say was, I love your music. The Great Peace March song, and well, everything, I love your music. She later sent this letter to Holly Neer, by the way, and Holly Neer wrote her back and said that she was so impressed by the letter that she had passed it around the tour bus and shared it with other people there. Anyhow, when I walked away, all the things I wanted to say flooded my thoughts, but it was too late. I wanted to tell her that her music, her messages, and melodies empower me. They give me strength when I'm depressed. They provide company and love and joy. These are religious words. This is religious language that's going on here. With love and joy and a strong sense of community when I feel desperately sad or lonely. The closing candlelight vigil surrounded the reflecting pool, and the march ended with prayers, chants, and meditations by representative leaders of different religions. Afterwards, there was a small party for some of the marchers, great peace marchers, on the George Washington University campus. Sunday, I attended a few hours of the WISP conference, then headed over to St. Stephen's and the Incarnation Church for nonviolence training. There I began to form ties with some of the marchers. We formed affinity groups for the next morning's protest of nuclear weapons testing at the Department of Energy. The marchers are truly the neatest, greatest people. They are unpretentious and true to their belief in the power of pacifism. There were marchers of every religious and political creed, of every age, from every state and many nations. They are people who have taken a serious look at the priorities in their lives and put nuclear disarmament before jobs, security, nice things, warm houses, and personal prejudice. Their community is strong, and it extends its arms all around the world. They are truly beautiful. This is religious language, all of it. The nonviolence training, scenario planning, and legal briefing went on till 10:30 p.m. My affinity group called itself Divine Obedience. We had an ex-nun, two deaf women, a gardener, a seminary student, GWU undergraduates, great peace marchers, a married couple, an anarchist, and others whose backgrounds I never learned. I mean, what do these people have in common, this motley crew, you know? Most of the group planned to risk arrest by committing civil disobedience the next morning. Spirits were high and the community intense when we left. Even the Christian Scientist could appreciate my intercession to Goddess during the closing prayer, and so forth. After leaving the church, I had to finish stitching a banner. Craig helped me, but we still didn't finish until 3 a.m. We slept in until 5:30 in that morning, so that's 2.5 hours sleep, and were quickly up and running. The first part of the morning went fast. I met protesters on the city bus on the way to the Department of Energy. At the site, last-minute details, music, and the first few speakers flashed by, even as I blinked the sleep out of my eyes. Before I knew it, Arthur Waskow was blowing the ram's horn, calling us to action. My group linked arms and strode to the main entrance at the lobby. Supporters, media, and police pressed close on all sides. The crush of people swarmed around us as we blocked the sliding doors. It was frightening for a moment because tensions were high. The jostling came close to angered pushing and fighting between confused people. In the doorway, our arms locked together, embracing one another. We began to sing. Microphones and camera lenses pushed up in our faces. Employees of the DOE and police peered out at us through the closed glass doors. Supporters chanted, "Stop testing! Stop testing!" A contingency of Buddhist monks chanted ohms and pounded drums in a rhythmic pulsing chorus. Employees tried to force their way between us and through us to no avail. The original intention of the action was merely to block off the garage entrances where the decision-making and high-up officials park. We wanted symbolically to keep people from getting to work that morning, to disrupt the everyday business-as-usual process of testing the most destructive force that has ever been unleashed on the planet. In fact, we managed to block off every garage entrance and the 40 doorway entrances of the three DOE buildings, effectively closing down the DOE for about 2 hours. There was a powerful, peaceful, loving energy at work. Our supporters ran messages from one door to the next. The spirit of Goddess was with us all, surrounding us, radiating from us and through us, guiding us, leading us to the roles she had set up for us. Sounds crazy? Not at all. We felt it. Some of the employees got angry at us and threatened to hit us and throw us to the ground. One man who was really upset called us Nazis. It frightened me that they reacted so strongly to our gentle persistence. At one point, I became so upset by this particular man's verbal abuse and threat of physical abuse that I had to leave the door. I had to get away and just cry. Paul, one of my supporters, came to me and held me and loved me. I told him how I could feel the angry man's fear. He was so frightened by our songs of peace and gentle stubbornness. The angry man couldn't understand us at all, so he reacted with violence. Paul understood my words and my despair. He described the strength of the spirit of our action and how he knew we were doing right. At that moment, as we connected for the first time in my life, I knew beyond any measure of doubt that peace will prevail. For the first time ever, I believed that we humans will dismantle nuclear weapons before we destroy ourselves and our planet. As long as this spirit survives, it will spread. Time will come when we all understand that we have to take responsibility for ourselves and our beautiful, living, nourishing planet, never to fear nuclear destruction again. The arms race is no longer a question of denominational or political views. It is not a question of making ourselves vulnerable to some invader. It is a question of survival and the survival of the ability to love. I mean, that's pretty powerful, I think. Nuclear war and the ability to love may disappear. I mean, that's... Okay. After a few hours in which crowds and media periodically came and went, the police came over and arrested us. They put handcuffs on us behind our backs, took our names, and loaded us into the paddy wagon. The crowds, which welled up around us, cheered, waved peace signs, and threw flowers. My handcuffs were loose enough to get my hands out, so once inside the truck, I took a flower out of my collar and tossed it to the police and the crowds. It landed at the feet of the police. I later heard the story of a woman named Lisa who was arrested at that time. Lisa resisted arrest by going completely limp. As they dragged her along, she kept her face down with chin up to protect her face. When she finally glanced up, all she could see was a stomp of black boots and my flower among them, a God-sent sign of blessing and hope. We spent the morning in one jail halls. Inmates joined in, she later said, you know, people that were in there for hooking and whatever else. Here's this whole, you know, a jail in that kind of setting. It's sort of like singing in the bathtub if you have enough people. I mean, because it's got hard walls, you know, and the sound fills and it resonates and so forth. Love was flying around the jail cells, one to another, and back again. The harmonic swells captured us all, and we experienced a community beyond words. These women are my sisters, my lovers, and the promise of our future. At 6 p.m., a guard came and released us. The charges were dropped. On the mundane level, I'm doing fine. My hair is growing longer, and my fingernails, too. and so forth. In any case, now, you know, if that is not a paradigmatic experience of community, experience of love, experience of vision, experience of commitment, takes an enormous amount of commitment. If you're, you know, young and have never seen a jail on any basis, it takes an enormous amount of commitment to be willing to do that. I mentioned to some of you Taylor Branch's Parting the Waters, which I read after I was here last time in June. The children in the South that went to jail by the hundreds and thousands for civil rights. Just an incredible grassroots upswelling of people who were frightened out of their gourd. Frightened, scared, but allowed the courage of the spirit of life to overcome that fright and that desperate kind of feeling you get when you don't know what's going to happen and when you're afraid for your physical well-being. So I think that those kind of political experiences. And they happen at lower levels in different groups. I remember when I taught at seminary, and I'd go to seminary coffees, and they would talk about the football game and who the blue chippers were and all that kind of stuff, and I didn't know anything about that. Or they would occasionally in season talk about baseball, and I still don't know who's in the American League and who's in the National League. I mean, I never have figured that out.
You're in a bad way.
What? I am in a bad way. I'm in deep trouble, right? And when they said the series was over, I didn't know the series was on, so it can go right by me, you know. And so I never felt, and yet it was a seminary faculty, and I would have thought there would have been something there that we had in common. You know, you think that seminary faculty over coffee are going to talk about, you know, Aquinas and Bonhoeffer, but not this gang. And then I would go in the evening to Urban Ministries, bored. And here was this strange-looking bunch of people. I mean, some of them really strange. 1970s, the year, 70, 71. And I didn't know most of them. Some of them I never did learn their names. It seemed like every time I went to a board meeting, there was a different group of people there. At least in part. And yet, when I walked in that room, I knew I was with a community. I knew I was with people that I could trust and that I could share and that we had something going. We strangers had something going together that I did not have going. Now, maybe, in all fairness, the rest of the faculty all had something going with you. They had their own community, okay? And there's nothing wrong, obviously, with football and baseball, all that kind of stuff. It was just my sense of alienation from the theological subculture and my sense of identity with the ministry social justice subculture. And that's a highly individual thing. As I say, the theological faculty all thought they were home when they were doing their coffee clutch. But it was frustrating over time to ask yourself, which community risked more, the Urban Ministries Board or the seminary faculty? By far the Urban Ministries Board. They used to do wild and crazy things. Which ones maybe put their lives on the line? Steve Larson, who was the urban minister at the time, he had his van machine gunned once. Somebody came up and just, or maybe it wasn't a machine gun, maybe it was a repeater rifle. But when he heard pow, 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 and he came out and there were a series of bullet holes in the side of his van. Who risked more? Who stuck their neck out? Who was willing to take on city council? Who was willing to enlarge, you know, the arena of good? That little cadre of people. And who made big, dumb mistakes? That same little cadre of people. I mean, we bought a house and fixed it up for homeless people, and then the homeless people trashed the house. And then it was declared a slum property, and we still had a big note on what now was a slum property. And the city was coming after us for being slum landlords. So, you know, I mean, you know, this stuff doesn't move in a straight line. And it isn't always up or anything like that. Do you have some comments? We probably should end about 1:45, I assume. That's in about 1 hour and 15 minutes. Do you have some comments? Otherwise, I'll talk a little bit about specific public policies.
Well, I think it's not easy to locate oneself.
That's right.
On an issue, somehow find a focus for one's political action. I think that's the key, is to, and it's a miracle or a mystery as to why people locate themselves, as you were saying the first night. I just got some documents from a research biologist at Scripps Research Institution, and he got incensed because in his hometown the undocumented, Hispanics were being run off the street. They passed an ordinance which said that nobody could solicit anybody for work on public or private property in Encinitas. And the ordinance had passed the city council, and he got incensed and organized and led and was the lead proponent in a lawsuit which turned that around. Here's an ordinary guy, kind of, a scientist, spending his life doing research on fertilization and all kinds of stuff. And he gets involved and becomes a public figure, actually, because of it. I'm sure his life will never be quite the same because of this event. But it had to be an event that touched it off. Something. What gets us located? I really don't know what gets us located.
I think deep inner symbol forming experiences, you know, like that. When you start saying, I am, I mean, how many of us would say out loud, I am an activist?
But I've got 19 major issues on my agenda that need attention. And there's no way I'm going to attend seriously
right
to 19 issues.
Right.
So you got to choose somehow.
Right, so how do you choose?
Yeah. And another thing is, if you if you don't locate yourself where an issue is, then it won't emerge.
Mm-hmm.
Where you live, where you work, where you place yourself in mm-hmm. life. If mm-hmm. you place yourself at Holden, the issues are only going to emerge intellectually, the deep political issues.
And I, you know, environmental issues are, given this setting.
But the environmental issues don't really emerge here except intellectually.
Yeah, not seriously. Yeah.
They're not serious. I mean, we have to manufacture them.
You don't see the deformations. Yeah. You don't really see the deformations because you're so removed. Yeah. Yeah.
And the stories about environment are where people's kids have been affected by the toxic pollution.
Uh-huh.
Whole movements have uh-huh. been started by one person where that sort of thing happens.
Yeah. I used to, I don't know what the answer to any of that is. There isn't an answer. So you just let go of that one. There are a series of answers. Particular to people and context.
The thing we did with the Central America is to send people to Central America. You know, the whole technique is to get people.
Get
there,
people in the midst of
and
it.
When they come back, then they're different. Now,
right.
Each issue is different, and I don't know how anybody decides where one is going to experience the issue.
Yeah, I did it. When I was teaching seminary, I did a lot of experiential education. Send people to spend a night at the Union Gospel Mission, have them go on police rides, have them go to, this is different, but go to black religious worship. They'd never been in black settings, dominantly black settings or Hispanic settings, or gay bars or gay church, or, I took a course, take a whole course to the valley, the Rio Grande Valley, hang out with farm workers and people like that. It's always very powerful stuff. Very powerful
stuff.
Well,
I would think if any one of us were going to really become involved in the hunger issue, we'd have to place ourselves really where the hunger is. One of our members of the community took this Church of the Savior money trip. I don't know whether you've heard about that, but it takes quite a bit of money to take the money trip. But it's about the use of your money and the use of your life. And they go to five countries and actually work with the poor in five countries. One of the places was with Mother Teresa. And, but they work. They actually have to take care of people in the context of the hunger situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one side of it is that sensitization to the problem. The other side is the feeling like what you do matters. And that's where, if you have an organized movement and you have visible marks of success from time to time, and that's how all the IIF organizing occurs, you know, if you start with a street light if necessary, but you got to win. You got to feel that what you did is effective.
But I don't have any emotions daily about hungry people. I know 40,000 people are dying today because of hunger. Maybe 40,000 kids under 5 are dying today because of hunger. I mean, you know, the statistics are.
Yeah.
But I don't have any. I don't feel that.
Yeah.
I'm not moved. I don't know what the rest of the people here. But
yeah.
I don't feel those feelings somehow. I haven't experienced that enough to have that really move me on the hunger issue.
Yeah.
I got intellectual knowledge that it's an issue.
Yeah. Well, and I think, again, it's why Americans got more easily into the peace movement, because it was their backyard they saw being blown up. You know, whereas hunger just was more removed, always has been more removed. And even when you see panhandlers on the street, you're always suspicious that they're hustlers anyhow, you know, and you're not sure that they're truly hungry or truly needy or just opportunists and stuff like that. One of the things that's helped me, none of this keeps me clean and clear, but taking a Guatemalan into my house who was in sanctuary for 2 years and listening to his stories. I didn't go to Guatemala, but I had a Guatemalan live there. There was a black guy who came from inner city, South Bend, Indiana. And he used to hang around, and I'd find work for him and try to get him, help him survive one way or another. And he was always a sort of pain in the ass. But at the same time, I probably got more from him than he got from me. He'd tell me about, you know, he had 8 brothers, all slept in one bedroom, and the 2 sisters slept with his mother and dad, and his father was, he said, an alcoholic, and all of his brothers had done time in the state pen. And he was like 24 years old, and he had done already 6 years hard time in the state pen. And he talked about, you know, when you go into somebody's house and you see this pretty trinket laying on an end table or something, you say, well, they must not need it, or they wouldn't leave it laying out like this, so you just put it in your pocket. And there was no guilt about it. I mean, they didn't need it, you did. And it's just a whole different world, just an entirely different world. And I got a lot from just listening from him coming into my reality. Remember when I moved to Washington, I sent out one of these form letters, you know, like you send. It says, dear friends, you know, come see me in Washington, you know, I've moved, I'm not ready for the world, da 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 da. About a week later, I get this phone call. It's a collect call from South Bend, Indiana. and they tell me his name. And I said, yeah, I'll take it. He says, hey, Dick. He says, you know, got your letter. I can't come just right now. You know, I'm not working, and you know how it is. I mean, he had a form letter. He doesn't know form letter. He didn't know I invited 100 people, you know. He thought I had specifically invited him. And he used my home as a mail drop because he didn't have a regular mailing address. And he got a letter once at my house, and he looked at it. This guy's 24 years old. He got a letter, and it's from his mother. And he said, I didn't know my mother could write. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. That doesn't infuse my emotions on a daily basis either. Okay, it doesn't, in all honesty. Nonetheless, it has a very powerful, indeed, has had a very powerful effect on my feelings about those kinds of issues, poverty issues. I think all of you know, I studied with Al in Chicago. I got as much out of doing my dissertation research out there in Uptown and Woodlawn on model cities. I got as much out of being out there in the community And I started to do Operation Breadbasket, and then it didn't work out. But in participation, I got as much out of living in Chicago from 65 to 70 and plugging into those communities as I got out of the graduate work. Now, I can say it the other way. I got as much out of the graduate work as I got out of the living in those communities. But those are the things that move you existentially.
I guess the issue I'm trying to get at is, where do you place yourself so that the political problem becomes your problem and not just a kind of exercise in some sort of discipline or responsibility? So you're involved emotionally, or you're really involved. And of course, the present direction says you place yourself with the poor. If you really are concerned with the poor, you would locate yourself with poor people somehow. But there are a lot of implications that to become political, kind of in the abstract, is one thing. Become political by virtue of your location in the context of the political issue is a little different.
But in terms of how things are going to get done, becoming political, you know, even abstractly and remotely, can cause things to happen that you may not get to happen, you know, when when you're with the poor.
Right. I think both styles are valid. Just as valid as my daughter doing a sit-in at the DOE and my not doing it, but my writing letters or something like that, or organizing people in local level. Yeah, you know, at one level, sure, community organizing with poor people, so that they are the ones that affect the system and the process, is critically important, and that needs to be done, period. And those people who do it should live with those people and not just be drop-ins. At another level, you know, there are people who can, there are an awful lot of middle-class people out there, dominantly white, though not only white, who can affect the shape of the system without having to live in the midst of poverty.
I guess I'm just questioning the locus for the motion on the hunger issue is over against the peace issue, which is a much more personal issue with everybody. I mean, the bomb is going to hit everybody.
Right.
And the environmental issue is going to hit everybody.
Everybody, right.
But that hunger, most, you know, three-quarters of America doesn't know anything about hunger.
Right. I think a lot of the locus comes from biblical stories. Jesus didn't talk about nuclear war, and he didn't talk much about, you know, waste disposal sites and polluted water. But he sure did talk about hunger, and he sure did feed people, and an enormous amount, at least the people I encounter. And this is not a prescription, this is just a description. An enormous amount of people I encounter are church people who in some way or another are rooted in those stories. And that's why Bread for the World always has at least some kind of edge over some other groups. Because the people who won't be with us on military issues will be with us on hunger issues because of those stories. I would like to just share something with you all. In a sense, I think people have to locate themselves in different places. There's no one place, there's no one lever, and there's no one issue. And it's okay to find the one where you can find a place and where your skills and talents fit. This is the current Bread for the World newsletter. And we have just put out, it should be in print this week, though we haven't seen a copy of it, Hunger 1990. And what I wanted to point to was the round parts, the summary of the main findings of this volume. One, at the bottom of the first page there on the right-hand column, militarization is a primary cause of hunger. Two, on the next page, national and international development efforts have often overlooked women's needs and skills. Three, environmental destruction, rapid population growth, and hunger are closely related. So whether you're working on, you know, military stuff over there in number one, or whether you're working on environmental stuff over there in number three, the payoff, it goes in all directions. Four, this is an economic system statement. Economic growth is an important part of overcoming poverty, but it is not enough. That is just more. If more means more 100 kinds of genes instead of 50 kinds of genes, or 100 kinds of new toys, more is not enough. It does not solve the problem. Five, progress against hunger and poverty depends mainly on the initiative of poor people and others in the developing countries. In developing countries, our government tends to look to other governments, and we have to find ways to be supportive of local efforts of poor people at local levels. Six, industrial country policies regarding trade, debt, and development aid often contribute to poverty and hunger. Some U.S. food aid contributes to hunger. U.S. trade policy can contribute powerfully to hunger, one of the great engines driving it. You can see, even though we deal with hunger issues, if you look at the two pages later, what do we wind up dealing with to get at hunger issues? Well, this past year, the Harvest of Peace resolution was focused on militarism. Budget issues, relative budget priorities, Central America, 1.4 million every day to El Salvador, poor people worse off than they were before. South Africa, how do you get at hunger in South Africa? You get at apartheid. The Horn of Africa, how do you get at hunger in the Horn of Africa? Well, for one thing, you quit sending military aid to Sudan and Somalia. WIC, the Women, Infants, and Children program. Agriculture, obviously, use of pesticides, subsidies, farm subsidies, ag trade, all of those are related to hunger. Third world debt. A lot of third world countries, people are poorer and worse off today than they were 10 years ago because their economies are strangled by debt. So things that not on the face of it aren't immediately related, like third world debt, what does that have to do with hunger? That there is payoff around hunger issues and environmental issues, debt for nature swaps, things like that. Those things are all integrally related. So I guess, my personal thing is to say, get into the issue that grabs you most. Find a community of people to work with, because you can't sustain very well by yourself. You really can't. I mean, the church would never have made it as one person over these centuries. Get into the issue that grabs you the most, and you don't have to feel guilty if it's militarization rather than hunger or rather than the environment. Pick the one that grabs your heart. It's okay to do that because all of this stuff is needed. Find a community of people who are willing to hang in with you and share with you and help strengthen your identity. Our identity in this it's hard to maintain. American culture continually bombards us, and we are seduced all the time into losing that consciousness. So find a group of people with whom you can maintain some identity over time and with whom you can work to bring about some kind of positive result. That's just very practical stuff, but I think it comes down to things like that. I used to do too much and do it not well enough. I used to do Amnesty, Fellowship of Reconciliation, Bread for the World, Impact, National Organization for Women, ACLU, and Sane Freeze. Basically, I wasn't doing anything except satisfying my need to do something. Basically, I felt good because I thought I was doing so much. Actually, what I was doing much of was satisfying my own self. My advice is find one major issue and stick with it and hang with it and get some background and get some knowledge and know that you aren't going to, if you're not doing Amnesty, don't worry about it. Not everybody can, and maybe somebody else will pick that one up and do it and form an Amnesty group. Or do Amnesty. And let's let go of something else. But focus, 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 focus. Without focus, there's no depth. Without focus, there's no effect. That's just kind of nitty-gritty stuff. But it's where, and I don't know that I sit in any privileged position to tell any of you anything, really. It's just, I'm just sharing with you where I am at this point, you know, what I've sort of tried to sort out over these different ways of going at it, parish, seminary, and now social justice group. Are there any other comments?
Well, what it suggests to me is that if Holden wanted to do something about this, it would have to form a Bread for the World
group. Right.
It's not going to happen by one person.
That's right.
Happen unless there's a group.
That's right.
And same in any church. If you're going to do anything in the church, you're going to form a
Bread for the World group.
It focuses.
Right. We have church groups. We have community groups. Missouri Synod Congregation over in Puyallup meets once a month on Saturday mornings. And they have Bible study, study an issue, and write a letter. They have worship. Bread for the World groups do worship, study, and action. Now the action is usually writing a letter. We have local groups all across the country. We have 400 or more local groups in cities all over. Sometimes they're 3 people, sometimes they're 15, sometimes they're 50. Some of them are in churches, some are citywide. But if you wanted to sustain something like this, you need a group of people who are willing to meet at least 1 hour once a month. And if more, fine. But in 1 hour, you can have a devotional, somebody can present an issue, and you can write a letter.